Well, anyhow, from that, I got the isocyanate, and I read over Ellen Bowes first, and I knew he used the standard method. There's no use of messing around. So I went down to the library, looked around a little bit, and found an alternate reaction. Instead of using the old lead salt and heating it, why I didn't use it, it's plethyl carbonate. I went upstairs and mixed them up, and 10 days, I took them down. I said, well, here they are, both of them. I had finished, because it was simple organic chemistry. But he says, well, you've got to learn the people around here. So I did. I said, what do I do now? He says, do what you want. So he literally let me alone from then on. The net result is I worked through the thiocyanates and made God knows how many derivatives and all the jazz and fashion for everything. But that was good because it was insecticides, lubricants, and all kinds of stuff. And then I got kind of tired of it. And one day, old Pop Reed, was it Hopkins? You probably knew about him.
Oh, yeah, E.M. Reed.
He was a consultant for us, and he came to the laboratory. And I said to Pop Reed, I said, look, I'm getting tired of these thiocyanates. I can't find what to do with. I think I'll make the oxygen compound. He says, that's a good idea. Well, I said, I haven't got any hood. Oh, hell, he says, what difference does that make, Butch? Just get a tube and put it out the window. That's 1935-36 chemistry. So I did it. I made a bunch of them. And then, since they were all new compounds, I take them around and try to find uses for them. And meanwhile, in the process, I was only at DuPont for about 6 months when I was made a group leader. And I was given two men to work for me, and that's another story. But anyhow, from that, I then got groups of people to work on, and I was assigned projects or picked them out myself, and I did whatever pretty much I wanted. I reported to the steering committee, which was the method of telling how you're doing, and included Greenwalt, who was the vice president of the corporation and a fine guy, and four or five other men, and you stood up there and you told them what you did, and either they liked it or they didn't like it, and you heard about it. Well, anyhow, I went around and did that, and I got into the various other problems. And then the typical of what I did was, I don't know how I want you to do this, but I want to tell you so you'll be quick. One day, Paul Salzberg called me downstairs. He says, Butch, we got a problem. I says, what's your problem? He says, well, we're just working up the patent situation. And we've seen we got one hole in the patent. Crothers says he can't polymerize caprolactam. It won't go if you try to heat it, and it's going to cyclize, and that's all that you get out of it. And he says they've tried it. And he says Peterson has proved that. He made it, he put it in a still, put it in a high vacuum, and distilled it and got nothing but him. He says, do you think he can make it? I said, sure. I didn't know what the hell I was talking about. But that was characteristic of everything I ever did. So I went back upstairs and had a new chemist, Illinois graduate named Bob Joyce. I said, Bob, we're going to work on caprolactam polymer. He says, hell, Crothers says it won't work. I didn't ask you that. I said, we're going to do it. So he said, you get out of the shop, get yourself a piece of pipe about 3 or 4 inches long, maybe 2 inches wide, put a cap on each end of it and bring it up. Yeah, maybe 6 inches. I said, then you load that with caprolactam. And then you add just a little bit of water. Not too much. A few cc's of water. And he said, well, what else? I said, spit it in if you want, but I don't care. But seal it up. Put it in a lead bath and heat it at 250 to 265 degrees for a week. Okay, we did it. The end of the week, we took it apart. And the caprolactam was all gone. It was all polymer. We dissolved it, and we found that the equilibrium was 96% polymer, 4% lanthanum. And with that, that was the end. That finished the polymer patent situation for DuPont. And that got me into the polyamide field, and I did a lot of work on polyamides and polyesters and what have you. Then about that time, I don't know when I'm, how my thing is, the ICI had a great, very, very great success in high pressure work. And DuPont had an agreement with ICI. And Bolton one day decided that DuPont needed a high pressure lab. So he would build one. What's he going to do in it? Well, he and a man by the name of Blubaker was in Salzburg got me together and says, Butch, we're going to build a high pressure lab. I said, what am I going to do? That's your job. They said, it's going to take us 6 months to build it. And in that 6 months, you're to write a new program every month. You submit it to us, and we'll cross out what we like and what we don't like, and then you can do it from there. So I did. Only one reaction stayed in it during the 6 months, and that one I never could do. But it's interesting because that one was solved about 60 years after I wrote it by Shell. But anyhow, so I got the laboratory, and of course the first problem was the polymerization of ethylene at lower pressures. And so that's what we did. And that work was done by a fellow by the name of Bob Crisp, who was a Northwestern graduate. And we tried all kinds of stuff, and we didn't get anywhere. And finally, I got back to say, let's take all that fancy stuff out and just put water in a little, and we did it. And then again, the reason things important. Water has been always an important factor in my life. Caprolactam, now poly. So we ran an experiment one day in high pressure with ethylene. And when we opened it up, we had some polymer. And so we coated that P, polymer TG. Thank God, number one. And that was what then got me into the high pressure work. And I had maybe five or six people working in that area all the time. Well, then that work was going along fine when we found that the polyethylene went best if we didn't have any solvent in it. Our original theory was that we should put a solvent in it, that the ethylene would dissolve in the solvent, and then that would be dispersed in the water, and that would give us the concentration. But then later we found that the water was all we needed. So anyhow, one day, Bob Joyce was still working on polymers, and we were talking about what we're going to do. And I said to him, Bob, let's get the worst solvent for polyethylene and see what happens. So I called up a guy that was working on it, and he says, carbon tetrachloride. I said, what? He says, carbon tetrachloride. I said, okay, let's try it. So we put water and ethylene and carbon tetrachloride in the system, and boom, we blew the disc out. Fastest reaction we ever had. So we go back and look at it some more, and finally we decided we didn't mind much polymer. And we didn't get polymer. We got a liquid. And the liquid was there instead of the carbon tetrachloride. Well, we looked at it, and not my time. And then I had a man that I'd taken some of my doctor's degree, the name of Jesse Harmon. He was working for me. He was 10 years older than I am. And he was working for me. He took it, and he said, let me have it. So he took this liquid we got in there, and put it in a still and fractionated. And we had the C1, 3, 4, and so. And that was the basis for the discovery of Teflon,
telomeres.
Telomeres. Mm-hmm. And so then we had a whole series of research. We did a whole lot of research, everything. It was important not only from that point of view, but because it was the first time that anybody had ever proven what the end group was in a bonded polymer and why certain groups inhibited the high molecular weight and so forth. So it became a very important program, and I lectured all over the country about it, and I got patents. And so that was that's how I got into that. And then the next one, which is an outgrowth of that probably, is I had a problem. We had a lot of work on polyamides, but the question was how high a melting point could you make them? Could you make them out of aromatics like terephthalic acid and stuff like that? And that was given to me. So I said, okay, let's go to work. And I had a fellow by the name of Dick Wiley. And Dick and I started to work on it. And we made them, but then we didn't have too good of luck. It's so high melon and so forth. Well, anyhow, in the course of that, we had a little Carver press, which is just a press. And in order to keep the oil from getting heated, we kept putting thicker and thicker pieces of insulating material. And we were able to fabricate some of these materials enough for operation. Mail them to get a patent, you know. So in one day, this is the time of the Second War. We were just in the war. And somebody, Brubaker, came up to me. And he says, Butch, I got a problem for you. I said, what's that? Really? He said, you know that the organic chem has been working on tetrafluoroethylene. And yeah, I said, sure, it's interesting. Well, he says, you know, they can't make it worth a damn. The only way you know how to make it is to put it in a tube, put a little salt, silver salt in it, they don't know why, and seal it up. And then after a while, you cut the cylinder apart and you dig the stuff out. Well, he says, that material has unusual properties. And the Atomic Energy Commission is interested in it. But he said, nobody get interested in that. And he says, the other thing, nobody can shape the damn thing. It won't dissolve in anything. Okay. What do you think? You think you could do it? I said, sure. So he called my two men into one of their high pressure lab, and Bob, I guess it was Bob Joyce. I think it was Bob Joyce. But anyhow, maybe it was Wiley. But anyhow, there you come. And he had left me a sample of polymer, which had come out. And he says, can you shape it? I said, sure. I said, don't ask me, just give it to me. So we just put in great big sections of asbestos in this thing in order that we could burn them. I said, we got a new one in there, let's try it. So I said to Dick Wiley, Dick, how's the press working? Oh, he says, it's working fine. I said, you going to seminar tonight? He says, yeah. Why? Well, I said, you go down and get all the asbestos cloth you can. And before you go to seminar, you wrap that damn thing up with it, asbestos, and get it as hot as you possibly can. Oh, said Butchie, he says, it'll boil all. I said, it didn't ask you that. I said, get it hot. And then he says, what are we going to do? I said, well, when it comes time to do it, we'll do it. So we went to seminar, and after seminar, we got two little plates, and put a little this polymer on it, and put it between the plates, and of course, smoke's coming out. And we pull, because the oil won't hold. Well, you pull, and after a while, we said, let's take it out. So we took out the thing and threw it in a bucket of water. That was the first Teflon sheet. And we did ruin the press. Well, so we took that down to Brew and told him, here's the sheet. Well, then of course, having known it could be done, engineers went to work. But he didn't have a synthesis. Well, it took us about, 6 weeks to reorient our polymer so we could run a high-pressure polymerization. Well, it was so simple. You looked at the physical properties of ethylene, you looked at the physics box, they're the same. So we said, simple. All we do is take the ethylene out and put the tetrafluoroethylene, the same catalyst everybody else is the same. Howard Young, who was the engineer running the damn equipment, and Bob Joyce, who was the chemist, and I, and we said, let's go. So we did. And I don't know what time of the day it was, but all of a sudden it was an explosion. And our high pressure lab had lost some of its valuable equipment. That's the best explosion I ever had. And the room in the place was filled with carbon. Why? We hit it too hard, which caused it disproportionate instead of polymerize. So anyhow, that was the first experiment. Well, and we said, well, let's get a tack hammer instead of the sledge. And we went back, and again in about maybe a month's time, we had enough stuff made and good enough that we transferred the process to Orchem, and they carried it on. And that gave the man that invented it, discovered Teflon, he got the Nobel Prize. I mean, the Inventors Hall of Fame, too. So that put me into the next field endeavor, which is fluorochemistry and many things that you can make. Well, here the telomere was an actual, because I could polymerize, I could make all kinds of derivatives with tetrafluoroethylene and some many inert material, and we made dozens of them. And everybody got a lot of patents. So that was that. And so that's what got me into that field, and I was in that. I did a lot of other things, but those are the best stories in that. Well, the next thing that came up was the war is now over, and GAF decided they don't want to. I've transferred. Incidentally, everybody said to me, well, I'll come to that in a minute. And I said, okay, I'll go. And I, going back to my first story now, 7 years have gone by since I started at the pond until the war is over. And Adams says, Butch, you better take that job with GAF. So that's how I moved. The other work was in the period up to that. And I want to go back to one other thing, because that leads to the Inventors Hall of Fame. I had Bob Crist working, who was a Northwestern man, and he was working on polyester polyamides. Because when we were looking at the high molecular weight stuff, we wanted things that would handle lower melting. And so we decided, hell, that's obvious. We just put polyester groups in it, and we'll have less linkage between the two. And so we started to make copolymers of polyesters and polyamides. And they gave these to Joyce, to Chris, and he'd make one. And I said, well, let's put 10% in, let's tie 20. And we made them. But then I got discouraged, because I couldn't make them fast enough. They didn't make, because the polyamide work was over, but the ester work was not started, because you had to get the water down or the ester off in order to get the molecular weight up. So anyhow, Bob Crist was working along, and we were making a bunch of them that weren't going very good. And I said to Bob, look, this is too damn slow. Let's button it together. Let's make the best we can, get the water down to 0.5% or something like that, and then let's button the damn thing together. He says, how the hell are you going to button it together? Oh, he says, that's easy. I said, we get some of my diisocyanates. I said, we're actually hydroxyl, carboxyl, and amides and amines. We'll tie them all together. The only thing is, let's not have any free ester groups in there. When we work, let's work with the fatty acid and stuff. So we did. And so we had this thing going, and we had a 0.5% of diisocyanate, and up goes viscosity, and the whole thing was done. And we made a lot of them. We made a lot of good work. And that's where I started that. Well, then I go back to Holmes. Holmes and I were good friends, and as I said, Holmes was not... he was bright, but he wasn't thinking in chemistry. But anyhow, Julian Hill gave him a problem. And the problem was he had a bunch of polyols, and he wanted to tie them all together. Julian Hill had been essentially a cellulose chemist. So he was thinking in polyols. So Holmes and I had lunch one day together, and I said, "How are you coming, Donnie?" He said, "I'm getting the first base." I said, "Hell, I'll tell you how to do it." He says, "How's that?" I says, "Hell, take those polyols and calculate them out, and that diet is signed, they tell them they're button together faster than hell." He says, "You mean it?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Where do I get the diet to sign it?" I said, "I got some in the lab." So I gave Holmes some diisocyanate. He took the thing, and that's what invented polyurethanes. I say that that invention took me 17 minutes, and I didn't pay any attention to it. The patent issued in 1939. It was filed in 1939. It issued in 1940, and before it had really gotten to DuPont, never paid any attention to it. Before it got to be a big business, I had moved. In fact, I was in my third job. I was now with the Kellogg Company. And again, Paul Salsberg came up to New York one day and said, "Butch, I got a question for you." I said, "What's that?" "Well," he says, "we just learned that IG have been doing a hell of a lot of work on polyurethanes. They entered this field because when they studied our nylon field, polyester, polyamides, and that kind of stuff, they found there was no room for them. So they had to find some field that they could develop in which there was no prior art." And he said they picked the urethane field, and they've been doing some wonderful work. I said, "That's interesting." He says, "Well, I think we're going to have to have challenged them on your patent." I said, "Okay." "Well," he says, "you don't work for us anymore. I just want to make sure that if we need your assistance, you'll cooperate." I said, "Sure, that's fine. Just do what you want, and that's the way it'll go." I said, "By the way, I'm working on polyester amines myself now." So he said, "All right." And I didn't hear anything more about it, except by the grapevine. And I later heard that IG and DuPont had made a deal. The patent was quite a while to run. It was, I guess it's 1942, 43, something like that. And the patent was relatively new. So that was the end of, that was what I, how I got that one. And it was just a good chemist, a question on the mind of the management was, can you do something? And I had started with the thing, nobody is ever going to say, "Can you do it?" till I say yes. And that's the reason I got into the high polymer field. Well, anyhow, that was the end of all the stories, basically, on DuPont. At GAF, I worked there. I was made the director of research, reported to one of the presidents, and my main job there was to hold their position in the acetylene field.
You were quite young to be a director of research.
Yeah.
You were 30...
I was 1935, 1942.
So you were 30...
I was director of research. When Adam said to me, "Butch, you can do the chemistry. You can stay here and you know you can do it." But he says, "That's not going to challenge you." But he says, "If you take this GAF job, you don't know a damn thing about anybody. You don't know anybody, you don't even speak the language. But," he says, "you do know the chemistry." And he said, "So, acetylene," he says, "you can learn that. You get a book and read it. And dye work and that kind of stuff," he says, "that's no problem. But they want you mainly is not to lose their position." Because the Germans were thinking they were going to win the war. Mm-hmm. But they didn't want to lose their position. So I was there 5 years as a taskmaster. And in that time, I had another problem I had never done. I never hired a man in my life. I never picked a salary in my life. So I had to decide, how do you pick a good man? Well, I had been around long enough, and I had college professors like yourself. They were friends of mine. And I said, I'm looking for a good man. And they said, well, look, here's one. And I had a hell of a time hiring him because nobody wanted to go to work for the German company at that time. But anyhow, I had a good enough record that people worked for me. So GAF, I was mainly a custodian of property and held it. I did a lot of work on acetylene, methylvinyl ethers, and stuff like that, but nothing really great. And then the war ended.
Hadn't GAF been taken over by the government?
Yes. It was taken over by the government.
Okay.
But it was a government property at that time. And it was then a private company. And I got that job in part because the government had to hire somebody to manage it.
Okay.
And I was not that type. And they hired a man by the name of Bill Zimmerly, who was in DuPont. And Bill Zimmerly was a commercial development man, quite old, old-timer. But he knew everybody, and he took the job. And he's the one that told GAF to hire me. So Zimmerly hired me
okay.
on my record at DuPont.